So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with a Modern Man playback for you, an interview from the archives, which we've dusted down and launched back onto your feed for the last Friday of the month. Why? Because if you didn't hear it the first time, we think it's worth your attention. And we try to pair these monthly reruns with our new stuff to bring a different perspective on a contemporary topic. So if you've heard our April 2024 episode already, you'll know that I've been meeting former drug dealer Stu Otten and talking to him about how he came to be part of Liverpool's criminal underworld and the dark toll that it took on his life. Well, it reminded me of this conversation you're about to hear with Robert Stone, which we originally released back in 2018 under the title Diving to Adventure. Robert made even more money out of illicit activity than Stu did. At one point, as he tells me in this chat, $1 million per month. And look, he's got a very different tone to Stu. It's a story set in exotic climes rather than Merseyside estates. He is someone who very casually drops details about boxes of guns and chaotic injuries and the casino in Lagos. At first glance, it's an adventure story. It's water off a duck's back. But there are similarities here with Stu's story. A difficult childhood, many regrets, and talking to God. For this month's Modern Man playback, The Diver Who Got In Too Deep. And it all starts next. Now, if I ask you to imagine a diver, probably you'll picture someone in scuba gear, or possibly, if you're thinking outside the box, one of those big Jules Verne-style Victorian diving helmets. But in any case, it's something most of us imagine people do for fun, as a hobby or as a sport. It's hard to think how you might actually make a living diving. But from oil diving to fishing boats, there are actually loads of ways to live off your diving skills, and Robert Stone has done them all. He's done a lot of other stuff too, or at least his aliases have, and not much of that was strictly legal. Robert first discovered his passion for diving when he was a teenager.
I had worked at a swimming pool when I was, 12 or something. One of the lifeguards brought in scuba gear, and I had borrowed it. Like, they, let me try it, and I was fascinated with all the treasure you find in a swimming pool, the bobby pins and chewing gum and quarters and, things like that. And I started reading all about scuba diving and, all the coral reefs. And then I came across a book by Hans Haas called Diving to Adventure. And Diving to Adventure was a story about a man when he was probably 18 or 19, left Germany right before the war, went to Curaçao, Bonaire in the Dutch Antilles. And for a year, they lived on the beach, spearing fish, taking pictures, and he wrote a book about it. And I thought that'd be fascinating. And two or three times a year from then, I tried to run away and go there. But, I kept getting stopped at either the Detroit border or the bridge or the tunnel or Buffalo or,
Literally run away.
Yeah, literally tried to go down. I never would have made it at the time, but as I got...
How old were you then?
Well, 13, 14, and 15, I finally made it. I was working construction in the summertime and on weekends after school, and I had saved a little bit of money, and I had enough to buy a ticket to Miami and over to Andros Island, because I couldn't make it all the way to Bonaire. And I went to the airport one time, and I told the guy at the airport, he said, I got a one-way ticket. I said, because I meet my uncle in Miami, we're going to sail back to Canada. And he thought, oh, have a great trip. So he let me go. And I got out and never went back. So.
Never went back home?
No. My father had already been gone a few years, and And it wasn't a happy home to leave, so it wasn't really an issue. And I'd gotten a fight at school, and I hit the vice principal. And, you know, it was one of these things where it was just finished. And I had young parents, married, and had kids, two kids by the time they're 20. And, you know, it's just, it's married too young, no money, this, that, other things, so. It was the most brilliant day ever. I arrived in the morning, and I had this big old trunk full of sweaters, you know, like, because I left Canada in February, and stuff I didn't need, you know. So I basically just dumped stuff and walked down the beach and swam in the water and was loving it. But I hadn't drank any water all day. I was got sunburned. The sun went down. I had no place to stay. And the one thing Hans Haas didn't mention in his book was the sand fleas. You know, they're like the Bahamian version of midges. And so the sun came down. I was probably had heat stroke. I was dehydrated. I was sunburned. And, you know, covered in salt. And it was getting cold. And I was getting bitten. And I remember crawling under this old fishing boat. And turning it, you know, just putting it down and to shelter from the midges. It was a horrible night, you know, just, you can imagine, crying myself to sleep sort of night. And, but then I woke up in the morning and hitchhiked into town. And there was only about two cars in Andros Island at the time.
So you're 16 and you basically have no money in your pocket. And you have a passport and a one-way ticket.
I'm still 50.
You're 50.
Yeah, so I was really fortunate I got picked up by a guy that ran the dive program at the hotel, and he got me a job at the hotel, Andros Beach Hotel and Villas, and gave me a room, and I worked on the boat for about 6 months, you know, just helping tourists and go and dive, and it was really, really magical. That lasted about 6 months, because I was Canadian, you know, the immigration heard about a white boy working at the hotel, and they were coming to get me. And there was a couple guys at the dock that Hank knew, and they were leaving, and they gave me a ride. They dropped me off in Bimini.
Where's Bimini?
Another one of the Bahamas. About 60 miles to the east of Miami. And I speared fish off the beach. Actually, I started doing that, and lobster and fish, and sold them to restaurants, and made quite good money, and did some other diving things that like diving for lobster down the Ragged Islands. I hooked up with a guy that had a shrimp boat, and we went down, and, you know, we were actually making, you know, like thousands of dollars. It was really quite good. But the Bahamian gunboats found out about us, tried to chase us out, so that stopped. And then these two guys that gave me the
Bahamian gunboats.
Yeah, they had four gunboats at the time, and one of them came down and ran us out. And
so but this is organized crime?
No.
This is the government?
Yeah, this government, like a navy. You know, their navy boat, gunboat.
So spearing fish and selling fish, that's not legal because why? You didn't have a permit?
The spearing fish was, you know, more or less okay, but we were getting hundreds of pounds of lobsters off the Ragged Island chain, and we weren't Bahamian. You know, we were an American boat with, you know, and no licenses and stuff like that. So it's illegal, but I mean, it's not tremendously illegal. And back then, you know, they didn't shoot at you like they would now, you know. But back then, they just were trying to stop us. But the two guys that gave me the lift from Andros Island were smugglers. They were part of a fairly large gang that was big in South Florida. But one of the things that happened along the way is we hit quite a big swell and a wave, and when it landed, knocked the compass loose and broke the compass. And one of the things that I had done in reading was learned how to tell the direction by using a watch. You know, you use the watch and at the sun, and you can tell basically the 60 minutes turns into 6 degrees each. And basically I guided them to where we had to go, and they were quite amazed at that. And I got offered a job to go salvage a treasure down in the San Andres Islands, which are kind of off Costa Rica, Colombia.
Went to salvage some treasure.
Yeah, well, it turned out like halfway down, they said, "Well, it's not really treasure, you know. It's we're going to pick up a load of marijuana. Do you mind?" And I said, "Not at all." You know, I said, "That sounds like fun." So,
and were you a marijuana user?
No, not at all.
So you're 16 years old and, okay, you've gone off on an adventure, but you found yourself eased into a world of criminality here. Like, one minute you're fishing, next minute you're being chased by gunboats. Now, fleeing gunboats, you're on your way to pick up some marijuana.
Yeah.
Did you think at any point along that chain, oh, hold on, I could get in trouble here?
It didn't really feel like that. It's just, you know, kind of a you're doing things and it's you don't get caught, so you don't get caught and you don't really worry about it. The other side of it with the marijuana, we made several trips and ended up getting larger and larger, you know, freighters coming up from Colombia, anchoring off in the Bahamas. We're running it over with little boats and, you know, making really good money. And then a few people started to get arrested within my circle and other people's, and I actually thought, well, I've been pretty really lucky with everything that's happened. And a couple of guys I'd met along the way were ex-oil field divers, Navy, but I ended up going to the original dream of going diving and just was a little bit more well-funded than when I started out. So I was probably, I guess, 17, by 18, maybe just almost 18.
Okay. So, I mean, I have a vague idea of what oil diving is. Mm-hmm. I don't really know.
In a river, we're salvaging barges, so that meant learning how to cut and burn or cutting them up or taking them out or, you know, working in a completely black atmosphere because the Bahamas, you see 200-300 feet, and in the Mississippi River, you can't see at all. You know, you go down 3 feet and visibility is gone. So you're working, feeling where the current is, where your hose is, you know. So I did that for a couple of years and eventually worked out into the swamps, which is, you know, working on small pipelines, repairing a leak or doing things like that. And then eventually offshore into deeper water where we're setting platforms,
that's
jackets.
The dangerous one really, isn't it?
Well, you're getting deeper and the work's, you know, bigger you know, I'll give you an idea, like the most highly paid job working from the surface was inside burn-off. So when they put a jacket, which is an oil platform, on the seabed, they put piles down the legs and hammer the piles down. And then you go down and basically burn the pile off below the mud line from inside the pile in order to retrieve the majority of the pile because they only need the bit that's anchoring the platform. So they flood the pile, lift you up with a crane, you know, you go down the pile, inside pile, which is maybe 36, 42 inches in diameter. And so you're 200 feet down, whatever, inside, and you're burning these things off. And you got double depth pay, which was great. So as a diver, you got paid the deeper you went and by the foot.
How did you go from effectively now being qualified in something that is well remunerated back into marijuana smuggling?
I had a couple accidents that I had, and some of my old friends would come to visit, and they were still smuggling, and they kind of thought it was pretty silly for me to be doing what I'm doing, risking my life when for the money I was making, even though it was a couple hundred grand a year, was still not very much compared to what they were doing. And one time I had a fairly bad accident and it got in an explosion blowing up. But I'd just got married and decided to kind of put it behind me. I bought an old boat and I took fuel from Louisiana and this old supply boat down to Nicaragua, where they had a war going on at the time. And the Hondurans were fishing shrimp and lobster down there. So they had to make, instead of going ashore in Nicaragua, they had to bring the catch all the way back to Honduras, to the Bay Islands, Rotan in particular. And so that was about 6 days. And of course, every time a boat comes in, there's another day. So they lose a week of fishing and they'd have to go buy the fuel. So what I decided would work would be I'd take them the fuel offshore and trade it for a shrimp or a lobster, whatever they were catching. So I'd sell the fuel at the Honduran rate, which was a couple dollars a gallon. I was paying 10 cents a gallon in Louisiana at the time. I would take the shrimp from them at local rates and then sell it back in the United States. So that worked out pretty good for a little while till the Hondurans thought I was running guns and stuff, and which we weren't. But
so actually, is there anything illegal about that?
No, nothing really. Nothing at
it's
all.
It's just so that the profits suggested to the government that you must be up to something. Oh,
yeah, it was because we had so much, you know, the fuel and the money and the shrimp and things. So the crews got a little nervous, but instead they armed themselves. But instead of throwing the boxes over the side or burning them or putting them in rubbish. They had left them kind of in a tip when they were clearing customs in Honduras one time.
Boxes of guns?
Yeah, like just, you know, rifles and shotguns and handguns and just the, you know, the box. Not a lot, but, you know, a dozen. So when the military saw the guns, they actually seized the boats thinking it was gun running, but it wasn't. But, you know, it kind of ruined the operation because the boats were seized. I had picked up some boats that I was using for this, and I also had another boat that I took off a friend that we'd use for actual treasure diving. We did some treasure diving off Florida. These fuel boats that from Nicaragua and the treasure boat from Florida, I converted them into longline boats, and we started fishing the Gulf of Mexico for tuna and swordfish. And I had read that the Japanese had longline fished in the Gulf of Mexico in the 50s and 60s, but left because they basically fished it out. And I thought, well, there's a good chance that all that had recuperated, and it had. So I took this 150-foot boat, I put a 60-mile reel on it, they put freezer containers in, and I went out for a couple weeks on the boat and tried it out, hanging glow lights off the hooks and fishing with squid. It was really interesting and incredibly lucrative. One of the issues with at the time, they had the Yugoslav mafia kind of in New Orleans that controlled fish prices and stuff. So every time then we started coming in with fish, prices would drop. In order to get around that, we set up our own fish distributing company. It worked very well. I got more boats, and then one of the fishermen got a hook through his finger, and we ended up giving the guy his share of the boat while he was off, because the big hooks, and he was injured. But there was a lawsuit came up over it, and the lawsuit was from his girlfriend, because that was her favorite finger, right? And we were going to have...
Sexually, that was her favorite finger.
Yeah.
And that was the lawsuit?
Yeah, it was $250,000, and the lawyers said that we wouldn't win, you know, we'd lose it, or it costs us much to fight it. And so I deflagged the boats, and I had spent some time in Brazil because one of the guys I worked with in the 70s that smuggling had was on the run, and I'd helped him establish and get himself settled in Brazil. So I went down and started putting a fishing processing plant together in Natal, which is up in the northeast of Brazil. And there were shrimp and lobster boats down there that were tied up because they had overfished their industry, and they weren't catching anything, so they're all tied up. So I basically started buying them 10 cents on the dollar and putting them to work up Brazil. And we eventually had 27 boats, about 400 or 500 people working for us. And we became probably the third largest fresh tuna company in the United States at the time, you know, distributing.
Wow.
And in a period of a couple of years, so...
So again...
Yeah.
I keep coming back to the same question.
Well...
Things seem to be going well.
Yes.
So why end up back with marijuana?
Because we'd done so well, and because I'd gone from nothing to 27 boats and, you know, a couple of million a month of fish flying up, and the government also, because everybody was working for me, had more or less just been released from prison for marijuana smuggling. So they, guys that I'd worked with and had got caught and had gone to jail over it. So they figured, you know, they put two and two together, got six, and figured we were smuggling. And then they had, you know, you ever hear of Geraldo Rivera?
The talk show.
Yeah. Well, they had a Brazilian guy like him. It was called a Key Agora. And he used to put his fingers together like a crosses, and like you're in jail, right? Aqui agora, he'd be there. So he did a big television expose on these Americans. But I'm not American, by the way. I'm Canadian. But the way he said these Americans are smuggling cocaine and out of Brazil. And
you weren't?
No, not at all.
So twice that happened. People listening to this will think that stretches plausibility. That twice you've been accused of drug smuggling with a history of drug smuggling, but you actually weren't. You can see why he would put two and two together.
What we were doing did not involve drugs whatsoever. What we maybe were doing in other places did, but not there.
What were you doing in the other places?
Well, like I said, I loaned a boat to guys to go smuggle from Asia to the United States.
Oh, but, so that was still an active thing?
Yeah, it was going on, but you've got no idea how the American government works anyway. Once they start investigating something and they spend millions of dollars investigating you, they have to come up with something. Because it's just like any other business. If they spend money and their superiors want to know where the money's gone, they can't just say, oh, we were wrong. Police surrounded the building, and in Brazil, the police are fine, you know. But now they know we're smuggling cocaine, you know. They want a lot of money, not to mess with us. But we weren't. And anybody that was good wouldn't work for us. Anybody that bad wanted a fortune. So really, from a company employing, you know, 500 people, it went to nothing, and just really a week. And one of the guys that was working with me had asked me to supply another boat for another operation in Asia, and I refused to do it. And then when everything was destroyed, went home, told my wife I was going back diving, and I called my friend up and I said, let's do the smuggle, but you know, I'm going to do it.
So, and this was a smuggle of what, from where to where?
It was basically ended up being 12 ton of marijuana from more or less Thailand through Vietnam out to the coast and up to Alaska and down to the States.
How long is that at sea? What,
the trip?
Yeah.
It's maybe 3-4 weeks. I can't really remember.
So along the way, I mean, I have no idea. Are there pirates? Are there government officials? Do you have to bribe people?
No, we had, because of some of the boats that I'd helped in the Gulf of Mexico with the fishing were Vietnamese refugees originally. I had some pretty good contacts in Vietnam with things, and I was able to get a little bit of protection out there from one of the Vietnamese gunboats that was stayed just in case they could intervene. Took it up, went through a couple storms, and there was the Exxon Valdez at the time. It was a problem because it had just spilled its guts everywhere and right in our offload area. So had to make a choice to change the location, and we were going to offload. And one of the problems was it was a different fishing area, so the way we had to offload it ended up not being able to put everything on board the vessel. So we ended up having to sink 4 tons there, which is still there. And when we arrived off the coast of Alaska, a Coast Guard helicopter flew out over us and asked us to identify ourselves, which was, you can imagine, maybe a little nerve-wracking. Mm. And we just said we were an oil field supply vessel. We're an anchor handling tug supply, about 200 foot. And I said, we were en route to Mexico, but we'd heard about this. And we said, we're not working for anybody. We just came up to see if we could help. And they said, stand by. And the vice president at the time, Dan Quayle, was on board the helicopter. And he said, guys, America needs more men like you. Good luck. And they flew away.
Wow. But you didn't actually have to then help with the cleanup of the Exxon Valdez.
No. And we just went on, did the offload, and sunk the container, and everything went very well, and nobody knew about anything, and which is the nice thing about a smuggle. People don't know. It's not like robbing a bank and everybody knows, you know, just nobody knows it happened.
That's and your wife in Scotland at the time?
She thought I was diving.
She really did think you were diving.
It was unfortunate.
She had no idea you were dumping marijuana in the sea.
No.
But at this point now, it's not a case of you running a kosher business enterprise with a few things on the side. This is now, you're now a smuggler again, right?
I did the one trip. A few months later, we found out my son was going to be born, and I decided to go and kind of, Nigeria seemed like it had a lot of promise. So
for what?
I had met a guy who could get the black market fuel at the time, which was a little bit difficult. And he'd got a big pipeline contract in Nigeria, but what had happened was the two main contractors, McDermott and Buigs, had boycotted him from getting fuel. Effectively, he'd run out of fuel, he couldn't complete the contract, they'd take it over, he'd be ruined. And I heard him moaning about this in a casino in Lagos, and And I just kind of said, well, I can help you out with that. And he didn't believe me, but charged him international rates for the fuel. And I'd bring him out, so I was paying maybe $10 a ton for it and selling it for 320. You know, 500 ton a time, it started adding up. And he took as much as I could get, so I started getting as many boats as I could get doing it. And
what did you think the end point would be to that, though?
Well, just, you know, just Nigeria is completely different in many ways. You know, you're probably one of the most corrupt countries in the world. You know, I kept getting arrested, but all the arrests were a way to extort you for money. And so I would go and get picked up with this guy, and I'd give him money, and then the next guy up would find out, and he'd get me arrested and picked up. And then so eventually I was dealing with an admiral. I wasn't getting arrested anymore, but it was costing me maybe $100 a ton to move the fuel out the river.
So that, how much cash would change hands?
Multiply 100 times 500 is, what's that?
50 grand. So 50 grand to the police every time you're moving fuel.
It started, you know, with that, but also started to, you know, make wire transfers instead of cash payments. So,
I mean, how much were you taking home?
Probably $1 million a month. So,
when I say where did you see this was going? Well, if you're taking $1 million a month, let's say you've been doing it for 6 months, that's $6 million.
Yeah, well,
how did you think you'd be able to convincingly tell anyone that $6 million was yours?
Well, I didn't really need to, because I wasn't banking in a country that required that. I was, you know, banking in environments where it didn't matter, in places like, you know, Austria and Switzerland, Liechtenstein and Gibraltar and the UK. Where the UK money would come in, it would be from regular payments from any of the companies, Chevron, Shell, Exxon. At the end, I had 23 boats working under contract to various construction or oil companies. So the money, I would have that going into accounts, and my payments for the fuel were, you know, wire transferred payments from legitimate construction companies. Because I was, you know, getting fuel and more or less a very unorthodox way, you know, eventually what I ended up doing was just kind of, you know, gangsters that were supplying the fuel. I ended up buying directly from the government, more or less, from the refinery. So, but I couldn't be pulling up my little boats to it. I needed a tanker, so I ended up getting two tankers, one small 1,500 ton and a 6,000 ton tanker. And I could just drive them directly to the refinery and load up.
And whilst you're dealing with all this, sort of, you know, stashing your cash away in various different banks and working out new ways to get more and more oil and dealing with corrupt people in the government of Nigeria and also gangsters as well, doesn't sound like you had a lot of time for your family.
No, I didn't. And, you know, by this time my daughter was born, and I had made a decision to kind of break away from the past kind of guys that I had been pretty loyal to over the years. I had made a trip down to the various spots along the coast. I was in the Congo, I was in Gabon, I was in Namibia, South Africa. When I was flying from Kinshasa to the coast, I think, Pointe Noire, we ended up, as we took off, we had a problem with the aircraft. It ended up landing on a bush strip in northern Angola. You know, the civil war was on at the time. Luckily, it didn't crash, but we didn't. And then I went over to Liberia, I think, from there, and I went, and because I had a tanker full of fuel in Liberia, because we were selling to the ECOWAS forces, which is based in Nigerian guys. We were getting a kickback to the generals to sell the fuel over there. They were peacekeeping in Liberia at the time, and ended up, you know, getting robbed by some child soldiers, and, you know, like 12, 13 year old kids all high on drugs and machine guns. And it was, you know, very, very close experience. And then got back to Lagos that day on the way to the airport, from the airport to my house in Victoria Island. We had a head-on collision, you know, so it was kind of those three things, plus my daughter being born. I was just like, my God, what am I doing all this for, when I actually have finances enough to not be doing this? And I had made a decision to sell the company, and I think the guy, when I was going to sell, he felt he was going to be removed. And he was the one, I believe, that told the government about my Alaska trip, which started indictments going. Nobody knew about this trip. And all of a sudden, now they know everything, you know, but how. And ended up getting arrested. And they rioted that day. They had 750 guys in the yard. And they came up, you know, carrying a coffin, saying, you know, chanting, Rob must die, it was painted on the side of the coffin.
The Modern Man playback continues after this.
I went to Lagos and got arrested. That was a result of the U.S. government with these indictments, and I had to pay my way out of there, and I went right on the run for the better part of 2 years. And so,
how did you pay your way out of being investigated by the U.S. government? Yeah, but it's a different thing, isn't it?
With the U.S. government, with the Nigerian government.
But they're acting on behalf of the U.S. at that point.
Yeah, but...
It's still a possibility to pay yourself out?
Yeah.
Where did you end up on the run?
I flew out of Nigeria and
ended up... Oh, by the way.
In a jet. Yeah, I had a jet fly in the money and I flew out on the jet.
So a private jet that had the money on it.
Yeah, so...
So using that method, you don't need to show your passport to anyone and you can pay people up.
You know, it's Nigeria. I went out to France. I had other IDs, you know, so I was using another ID. And a little while later, I got my wife and children down, and we stayed in the Alps, in the French Alps, a place by Chamonix. And
what were you telling your children about what Daddy did for a living?
Well, they were still young. They were only 3 and 4. And I just told my wife that I had tax problems, you know, which...
Oh, she still didn't know?
She never did know anything, you know, until I actually got arrested. But she never did know.
The pressure of that, keeping that double life up, is immense, isn't it?
It is very stressful when you're doing several different things and several different IDs, and it's difficult.
Was there a part of you that thought, actually, I should just tell the truth, it'd be easier on myself?
Well, there's an old saying, you know, tell the truth, there's less to remember, right? It was a very difficult period, and of course... Being on the run and the companies running a little short of money, trying to get money, the companies going from 1.5 million a month to, you know, 500,000 a month, and the Shell and all these oil companies are here and you got problems, so they're not paying you. Maybe they were paying me, but, you know, it was getting siphoned somewhere. And then once the warrants were out there, every account I was associated with in my name was locked up and closed. I had very limited access to funds except for funds I had in different names. And even those were starting to become difficult. Like the one I had in Liechtenstein was the lawyers that had handled it didn't want to release it to me. And there was no reason they shouldn't, because they didn't know who I was. They just sent something. So they said, well, prove it. Prove where this money came from, you know. And just, and so I ended up having to, you know, more or less force them to go into the bank and give me the money. And, you know, that entails everything you can imagine. I took two of the brothers and another friend of mine and held a gun to the one guy's head, and the other guy held a gun to him and took him to the bank and got my money out the bank and in a safety deposit box, which all of it wasn't. It was, you know, about a fifth of it was in a safety deposit box, and the other was in an account which they couldn't touch because the government had seized it or locked it, they said.
And eventually it did catch up with you. How did that happen?
Yeah, because the when they told the authorities that, and they figured out who, you know, because it was another name, and then they told me, you know, my name, and they figured all that out, and then they put an extradition warrant to the United States to release me, and we were fighting the U.S. government at the time to transfer me to a Canadian. According to my plea agreement, I had a transfer treaty in it, and end up getting extradited to Liechtenstein over it, where I really thought I was going to go do 5 or 10 years there, but didn't, very luckily. You know, just it's been an angel on my shoulder for a long time, even though a lot of bad things happened. I just came up with a few statements which exonerated the lawyers and didn't place blame. And at the time, the Liechtenstein's authorities didn't want publicity about being a money laundering place for cartels, which basically... They were.
Yeah.
And I just said, keep the money. I'm not after the money. If you don't, you know, I just want to go home to my family. And there was a lady judge, and she dropped everything and said, asked the lawyers, is this true? Were you just scared? Were you just scared you're going to get accused of money? And did you make this up? And they just said, well, yeah, kind of, yes, you know. And everything just went away. They dropped it, and I went home.
Home being Aberdeen.
Home? Yeah.
And did you think, really, you've had a lucky escape there, it is time to change?
Oh, without a doubt. I had already...
And we'd had 2 years to think that.
Long time ago, I had thought that. I really recognized the fact that my loyalties were misplaced, you know, like this whole thing, you know, for your organized crime family and it's everything and your family's next. And it's just not right, not true. And the people who really, only people you should be loyal to is your, well, it really is your children, you know. So I was very fortunate to be able to spend, I guess it was 6 years, a little bit, maybe 7 years with my wife, making up to her for the years that I didn't treat her so well. And then unfortunately she died very suddenly. So,
of what?
She had a stroke.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was, we were running and she was very fit and healthy and everything and had won a marathon the weekend before. But what, as I found out, what young people, young healthy people dying of strokes are usually for 3 reasons. One, sit-ups at a gym. Maybe on a ramp and you're grabbing your neck and you're maybe touching your elbows to opposite knees or something like that and you tear your neck because that's what happens is you put a tear in your carotid artery. Women at, or men too, but it's mostly women at beauty salons getting their hair washed. That's the second biggest cause of stroke in young people. And bad dreams. So that's what Linda had, was a bad dream. So the just startled in the night and tore her carotid artery, which when she exercised, they went for a run, created a flap, and there were signs there of a mini stroke, but we didn't realize it because the doctors, when we went after it happened again, we went to the doctors and they just said it was maybe a detached retina and they were checking things, but so it turned out that's what it was because she suffered a major one later that day and died 4 days later. So,
and at that point, what were you doing professionally?
My children were 10 and 11. I couldn't go to the store without them worrying if I come home. So for the next several years, I just, I built homes, you know, built a home and, you know, sell it and build another one. That way I could drive the kids to school and maintain it and do stuff. And then one of the guys I used to work with in the oil industry, we came to buy one of the homes, you know, and we started talking and he is telling me he's working in Iraq and all these drilling programs and showed me pictures of him in flak jackets with the guys and he's working in offshore wind and it got me excited because, you know, I was golfing and building houses and looking after the kids. It was, you know, it gave me all these memories of doing stuff. So I got involved with him. Just as we get things set up, I found out I had cancer and I had to go to the hospital and almost didn't get out of the hospital. Very close, like, I mean, literally, lawyers and priests, and my children were outside the door. Their grandparents had died and everything else, and they didn't, of course, know. I hadn't been in contact with my family in Canada for decades. They just wondered what they did in their past life, you know, because everybody around them had died. I couldn't open my eyes, you know, and this priest who had performed my wife's funeral, the father-in-law's funeral, the mother-in-law's funeral, and had kind of been there to speak to sometimes. And she came to me and she brought kind of an anchor crucifix thing. And she said, if you ever, you just, you know, hold it. But they didn't actually, I had it in my hand. It wasn't in my hand, it was in the drawer. But I remember that night pretending it was in my hand and just thinking, it's like, oh, I didn't want to leave the kids. But basically that next morning, my body rebooted. You know, it was about 8 days after the operation. And
do you think that's kind of mind over matter or do you think it's God?
It's as religious an experience as I've ever had in my life. I was a conscious thought of, like, God help me. There it was. And
when you thought you were about to die, did you look back on your life?
Yeah, there's lots of things, you know. You just go, something funny, you know, like I'd never been to Sicily and I can't believe I didn't go. I always wanted to. I was very happy that I'd got to spend the time with my wife that I did because she was really, really good and by putting up with me and staying with me and because don't know how she did.
Did you, when but you look back across it, did you wish that you told her the truth?
No, not at all because she would have just got in trouble. If I hadn't done all those things, that would have been a lot better.
I mean, you tell your story with a smile on your face and there's a kind of there's a fun boy's own American made style romp about some of these experiences. But I imagine fearing for your life, being on the run, dealing with corrupt police officers, it isn't really fun.
No, it's not at all. It's I remember standing in Chamonix one day with you know, the business falling apart, my kids living under another name, everybody that I'd ever known had already gone to jail and ratted me, and not knowing where to go. You know, like I was literally, like I had one foot nailed to the ground, and I was turning around in a circle, couldn't get my breath, and just couldn't remember what I was doing. You know, just like, where am I going? What am I doing? Who am I? I sometimes call people and who's this? And I'd have to look it up. Who am I today? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you go into a place and they say, happy birthday, Feliz cumpleaños, you know? And it's like, who are you talking to? And then realize that, you know, that person you are that day is his birthday, you know? That's not a life I miss one bit. And some people say, like, the going to prison or being bereaved or cancer, you know, it's just like God's wake-up call, you know? And I laughed the last time I heard that. I think it was after the cancer. I just said, I looked up to the sky and said, hey, God, I'm awake already. You know?
Robert Stone. If you enjoyed that, there's more, a whole lot more, in his book, Chasing Black Gold. And if you've been wondering what Rob's been up to for the past 6 years since we recorded that interview, well, he sent us this voice note.
Hello, Ollie. Thank you very much for having me back and wanting to hear from me again. The last few years have been really busy. I got engaged, moved back to Canada after almost 50 years away, left Scotland and moved back to a small island off the west coast of Canada in the Straits of Georgia. And it's like living in a set of a David Attenborough documentary. We got orcas off the coast, humpback whales, bald eagles in our trees, sea lions, you know, swimming by. It's just incredible. Really, really, really is. And my son had a baby boy and his partner had a baby boy. My daughter moved back to Scotland from Brunei, so that was fantastic to get her closer to home. Other than that, I've been volunteering as a frontline firefighter and medical first responder with our local fire department. Whatever spare time I have is left, I'm writing a sequel to Chasing Black Gold. Anyway, been a great, great few years, and thanks again. Bye-bye now.
Thanks, Rob. And thank you. If you have a suggestion of a favourite interview that you'd like us to replay on a future edition of Playback, then drop us a line. It's modernman.co.uk. Remember the two N's on the man, and fill out the feedback form there. Also on our website, you can browse all of our back catalogue, and you can support the show financially by buying us a beer. Please do. We're an independent production. I've been Ollie Mann with producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you with a brand new show on May the 10th.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.